You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hello, everyone. We're in the sixth Sunday after Pentecost, or Proper Nine, and today we're going to be discussing 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 to 10, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 2 to 10, and Mark 6, 1 to 13.
And we're joined again this week by the Reverend Dr. Gary Wirrati-Deverell, who is the inaugural Vice-Chancellor's Fellow in Indigenous Theologies in the University of Divinity. Gary is an Anglican priest and a Trelawai man from northeast Tasmania. Thank you so much for joining us again, Gary.
Good to be with you yet again.
Oh, and I must say, Gary is also the author of a wonderful little book, Gondwana Theology, which we explored a bit in last week's episode.
We did, and we highly recommend. It's a great unpacking of the ways that Indigenous spiritual traditions and Christian spiritual traditions speak to each other. And there's the last third of the book is an actual liturgy. It's accessible and it's profoundly practical, those don't sound like lofty titles, but I mean that in the best possible. This is a book that I think every minister should actually have in their study.
I think that'd be a great congregational study book, everyone.
Yes, it would. There you go. Thanks, Gary. We'll take royalties from the massive sale.
I'll pay you later.
Excellent. So we're all going to get rich out of this, sure.
Should we kick off with the 2 Samuel reading, Robin?
Yes, we should.
So it's a bit of a turning point in the history of King David here. So it's a couple of years after the death of Saul.
Yep.
A nation had split in two. God had promised that David would rule over the tribes of Israel, but only two of the 12 had accepted him as their king.
Yep.
And so this is the time when the other 10 are coming around.
Yes. So one of the things to notice exegetically is we have repeated sort of parallel almost phrases in verse 1 and verse 3. All the tribes of Israel came to David, and he's in Hebron. Mm. And then in verse 3, all the elders of Israel. I mean, it feels redundant, but this is how the Hebrew Bible stresses something of significance, that there's now massive unity. And the conquering of Jerusalem that happens next, not without its problems, we'll get to that in a moment, goes and basically steals it from the Jebusites, who are a Canaanite tribe. But it's a little bit like in Australia, the choosing of Canberra, or in America, the choosing of Washington, D.C. We've got this unification of the tribes and now a new capital that is Jerusalem that's chosen.
Politically.
Chosen for political reasons
rather than
because it doesn't belong
ones.
To any tribal group.
It's called the City of God or something in the Psalm today. But
becomes the City of David.
We should point out that the lectionary presentation this week is somewhat sanitised.
Mm.
So there's some fairly concerning bits in verses 8 particularly about how the blind and the lame will be left out.
Yep. And we can return to those details in a moment and why.
Mm.
I think if you're going to preach on this, obviously just read all 10 verses.
With an introduction.
Yes, with perhaps some context. The other thing I found interesting, and it's not really the focus of a sermon, but if we look forward to Jesus, you might notice here that David is 30 when he's anointed as king, and then we get told he rules over this unified kingdom for 33 years. And the point about Jesus is that when the gospel authors go to talk about Jesus, they'll talk about him sort of entering his public ministry around the age of 30 and then dying at 33, there's a sense. So, you know, that's not that the Old Testament is predicting Jesus, but rather that the New Testament authors are very much portraying Jesus
echoing
in this Davidic kingship line. Mm. Gary, what do you notice in this rather strange anointing of a king reading?
Well, what I see is the writers of history sanitising history to suit themselves. So
that's never happened anywhere else.
No, that has never happened anywhere else. This is the only place it's ever happened, Robin. I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at the conquest narratives when the Hebrews come up from Egypt and move into Canaan, Basically, many of the texts are genocidal, really. You know, they tell, in the name of Yahweh, their God, they tell the people to go into Israel and kill everyone, you know, men, women, children. And indeed, in some of the Samuel texts, they also have to kill all the animals. And you know, they get into deep trouble if they don't kill all the animals. So it seems to me that when we have these texts that kind of focus in on David as the sort of anointed king, and focus in on Jerusalem as the anointed king's dwelling place, what you've got here is the loudest, most successful voices in the Babylonian sort of theological conversation, interpreting Israelite history in a particular way, so that certain clans, let's say the tribe of Judah,
yes,
it's their version of history that wins, and everyone else's version of history that loses. Mm. I mean, in fact, it's probably quite likely that whenever you get any kind of tribal federation in Israel through this entire period, it involves both indigenous people and the people who've come up from Egypt. And it involves a lot of the tribes which are actually excluded in the written versions of the texts. And so it's way more complex than the text would make it out to be.
Yeah.
It's like writing a constitution, for example, and excluding the fact that this country here, Australia, was occupied for 130,000 years by 300 nations before Europeans got here. It's a bit like doing that.
Yeah.
So how do you, well, maybe you wouldn't choose to preach a text like this, therefore. So would you present those problems, for example, in a sermon in a way that was accessible for people and then proceed to seek the good news in it? Or how do you approach it?
Well, I would, I don't think you gain anything by avoiding the text.
No.
And in fact, the original version of the Revised Common Lectionary doesn't avoid these texts. Mm. But different churches make their own versions of the lectionary, and it's very interesting how different churches leave certain bits in and leave other bits out. Mm. But I don't think you gain anything by avoiding these sort of difficult texts. What you're better off doing is just saying, well, this is a voice in a theological conversation where there were many voices, and it's the voice that won in this particular, solidified account. But actually, isn't there something to be learned by also looking around for those other voices which are not strong and not represented here? Are they not also speaking in the name of Yahweh, you know?
Mm.
So I tend to approach it that way, and especially when you're dealing with, you know, small paragraphs, have a look at the book all around it. If you're teaching on this text and it's the only time you speak on Samuel during this month or whatever, give a little bit background about what else is going on in the story and who's excluded and who's included and what's going on with that. So I just think do all that, and then just, you know, a good preacher ends up with questions, in my opinion, questions about what you do with that rather than sort of nice, solid doctrinal answers, which end up being as problematic as the text itself. So
Yeah.
I just had an idea for your next book on the back of it. That's a lectionary that you would come up with.
Oh, that sounds like an awful lot of work.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so
perhaps, it does. Perhaps you could do that, I'm happy to look over it later.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of work for anyone, but it would be and there are people working on those sorts of things. There are.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, that the churches do alter the basic one, as you said, and I was interested in what a First Nations lectionary might look like.
Yeah.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah, where we don't. I mean, and part of that theologizing that you're naming, Gary, is, you know, where this particular section ends in verse 10, and this is the particular portrayal of David here, of, you know, David becomes greater and greater because the Lord God of hosts is with him. So it's this sort of divine, it's a portrayal of David as really living into his divine calling as God's anointed king. So, you know, that's part of the framing. But I think what the lectionary has left out, and, you know, verses 6 to 8, about the lame and the blind, it's partly because these are very complex verses and there's endless academic articles talking about what we do with them and what they actually meant in their context. One possible reading, and one that I quite like, by a scholar called Anthony Ceresco, who wrote this while working in the Philippines, talked about there's foreshadowing here. So even though there is this narrative, you know, as you've just described, Gary, of kind of a sanitized greatness, we get this foreboding of, you know, the blind and the lame won't enter Jerusalem, and possibly pointing to the demise, the crippling, metaphorical crippling of this very great Davidic kingship, because written by later authors, they know this isn't going to last forever. This is not the great kingdom that's going to stand. And if we go forward in the biblical text, ultimately, one of those stories of conquest is of King Hezekiah, one of the kings after David, who watches his own sons get put to death and then is blinded as punishment before being deported. So that perhaps there's some
writing in
clever foreshadowing going on in the very narrative of greatness. Now, that's just one possible interpretation. Other people have pointed to whether the Jebusites were literally using their blind and lame people, which is a way of talking about anyone with any kind of disability, as a kind of frontline attack, you know, like a defense, which is awful and needs to be named for the horror that is. Or that it's a taunt that, you know, even our crippled people could defend this city because you guys are so terrible. And, you know, so there's multiple ways to look at this, none of which are great and none of which anyone who works in disability would want to say is how we need, you know, it's that caricaturing.
But it does illustrate Gary's point about the history from the winner's point of view. You know, whatever reason it's in for, it illustrates that we need to approach it with a sense of complexity.
Yes. Mm. But perhaps with this thread of awareness that it's not quite as perfect as it might seem. I think we need to name too in these stories that, you know, one of the first acts of kingship as a unified king, and David's already been running around the country being this warrior, is to, you know, take over somebody else's city. So it's displacing, and this is how conquerors act throughout time and history. And we in Australia who are Western or Anglo are part of that history. So there's a way to speak into that and let this story make the kind of links you just did with the Constitution, Gary. This story connect with our story. Do we want to move on to 2 Corinthians, or is there anything else we want to say about Samuel?
I have nothing further to say about Samuel.
you're ready to move on.
So 2 Corinthians, that says rather different things about the weak and, you know.
Yes.
The lame.
And this is one of those texts I suspect lots of preachers avoid, because it's whole like, I know a man who went up to the third heaven. It's all a bit mystical and strange. And
he's talking about himself.
Yes, Paul is most likely talking about himself here, and this experience of being led into some kind of divine mystery that no mortal is allowed to repeat. And part of his, there's a fair bit of defending of himself as an apostle in 2 Corinthians.
I think we referred to that last week, just because they had rejected him initially and were coming around to it.
Mm. So what did either of you notice in the text? What do you want to pick up on here?
Well, I guess for me a couple of things. It seems to me that that one of the besetting sins of successful spiritual leaders, I use successful advisedly, is, you know, the ever-growing size of one's ego. Let's say you've let's say you've written a couple of books and you've got a fancy title that's been given to you by the University of Divinity.
hypothetically, let's say.
Yeah, that's right. let's just hypothetically talk about such a person. I think it would be very easy to over time, not necessarily all at once, but just over time, to get seduced by your own publicity.
Yep.
And end up with a very, very large head, which is fairly antithetical to the kind of stooping to conquer kind of Shakespearean logic of the gospel. it seems to me that that what Paul is in a fairly deflected kind of way, displaced kind of way, referring to here, is actually a fairly common experience. I mean, I know for me, I've got a couple of disabilities, let's call it that, running. One is I've got a chronic pain problem, which means that there's just a whole heap of things that I can't do. I can't squeeze into any given day. In recent years I've worked out that what I thought was just maleness and introversion was probably actually autism. And and that means there's just a whole heap of social stuff that I don't pick up on. I can have a conversation with one person and get most of what they're saying to me from their body language. But if you multiply that to two people or three people or more than that, I'm in big trouble. There's just a whole heap of stuff that I'm missing in terms of what people are trying to communicate to me. And that can get me into all kinds of trouble all the time. So, you know, everyone will have their own story about this stuff, but certainly in my life, those things which might be seen as, terribly tragic things that are limiting what I might otherwise be able to achieve in the big wide world, I think in this Pauline perspective can actually be seen as really, really good things, indeed even gifts. Perhaps it's a gift that I can't spend 24 hours a day trying to massage my own reputation. Perhaps it's a really, really great gift that I can only talk to one person successfully at once and hear all that they're wanting to say and have to concentrate really hard. I mean, maybe these things are actually gifts which, if taken seriously, provide a way to understand success as actually making space in your life for the other, for other people. You know, your own limitations, in a sense, can be a kind of imitation of the divine limitation in making space for creation. The divine limitation in sort of Trinitarian theology, whereby God withdraws into God's self and actually to make space for the other members of the Trinity and the creation itself to be, to experience life, to grow and to nurture. So limitation or weakness, as it's put here, it seems to me there's a deep spirituality here if we're open to hear it. It's the spirituality of strength through vulnerability, of self-limitation, in this case imposed from the outside, not chosen necessarily, but self-limitation in the way that actually makes room for others. I mean, I grew up with a father who had 12 back operations and was unable to work. And lots of people would say, oh, that's a terrible tragedy. He'll never be able to realise everything that he could do in his life. But I can tell you now that he was around. He was around and available. And people from around the very small town that I grew up in would be dropping in all day just to chat. And I tell you, just by that availability and that being around, my dad had a sort of really amazing ministry, I would call it, a ministry that came out of incredible disability and and limitation. And I think that there's something in this passage that would point us in those kinds of directions.
It's counter, and I mean, it's obviously profoundly countercultural, what you just said there. But also I'm reminded of stuff you said last week about the sort of the urgency in which we live often. And what you're describing there with limitation is it's an invitation, a command, an imperative to patience. It's a slowing down in so many ways to be with the other when we live with competition and busyness and, as we say, success.
Yeah, and what I heard in there, which you put far more eloquently with talking about the Trinity, but a reliance on the other, right? I mean, if you have any of these, when we have limitations,
you need help. You have to ask for help.
Physical or mental, and often we don't recognize spiritual limitations. We need help. We have to rely on other human beings because we can't do it. So it forces us into community that we might otherwise not seek, perhaps, or want to be vulnerable and open to. So the thorn in the flesh here, I mean, and again, people have hypothesized all sorts of things, some of which are not very helpful about Paul's thorn in the flesh. But in its simplest reading, it is literally something that that stops him ascending. The language of, in the NRSV is being too elated. But he's talking about a spiritual ascension into this third heaven, and the thorn in the flesh stops him ascending too high. I think in this context it's almost like a limitation on his knowledge, and he's boasting in that weakness, which in the context here is about, you know, if there's limitations on your knowledge, spiritual knowledge, then you have to rely on God.
But he would also, wouldn't he be talking against the Gnostics who believed in a special kind of knowledge that gave you a faith advantage? I would hazard.
Perhaps, those resonances might be there. I mean, this is also very apocalyptic, and we have other texts that talk about the demons preventing these are later non-biblical texts like the ascension of Isaiah and the apocalypse of Abraham talk about these figures being prevented in their ascents from getting too far up into the layers of heaven, which are, again, symbols for being closer and closer to God, by the demons that stop their elevation. And some of that is, again, just a way of speaking, I think, of human limitation in this sense around knowledge. But Paul does this with his foolish language, right? Which, I mean, I have to admit, I find very challenging as someone who trains candidates for ministry. And there's the part of me that is very worldly, and I would want to defend some of it, that says, we need the most excellent people going into ministry. We need them to have wonderful skills and gifts. But this text challenges what those skills and gifts might look like and what we consider, you know, what in worldly terms we might consider weaknesses that actually mean people could have profoundly fruitful ministries. And that for me is a tension that I'll own for myself is often hard. That's where the real discernment comes in around.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, if you take 1 and 2 Corinthians as we have them, as opposed to the way we might have had them in various different letters and fragments and whatever, there's a sense in which, you know, this 12th chapter of 2 Corinthians mirrors the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, where there's all that discussion about the way in which knowledge can be either, you know, serving worldly agendas, as it were, of power and influence, or it can be the kind of knowledge which knows foolishness and knows its limitations and is okay to work with that, you know. With Christ as the kind of primary sort of parable of all of that. So it does seem to me that it's not so much knowledge or not knowledge, it's what kind of knowledge is helpful, you know?
Yes.
And this is one of those passages which is saying, well, the kind of knowledge that puffs up is not as helpful as the kind of knowledge which is shown in love, where you can intimately get to know another person, get to know how life is really like for them, and in the process engage who you really are and who and what life is like for you, and just in the ordinariness of that kind of conversation, perhaps discover something of how the weakness of God can be a great strength, because you have to rely on someone else. You have to rely on the person opposite you. You have to rely on God. Mm. You have to rely on the stories that you've received about the Christ who dies, is tortured in order to, you know, enter into glory, and embrace all those kinds of paradoxes. There's no room in a big ego for any of that stuff, you know.
No.
Because you constantly have to maintain your image, and it must be exhausting.
Yes, know? To always be right or to always be
it
the
must be, yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm not the only person I know who's been deeply caught up in these things. So I think most of us can relate to this in one way or another if we've got past year 10. But it seems to me that this is calling us to something that's a little bit foreign to all of that.
I agree.
If you're enjoying By the Well, please take a moment to review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you've been listening to Gary Deverell, who's joining us as the guest today, author of Gondwana Theology, A Trelawe Man Reflects on Christian Faith. We're going to turn now to the gospel reading for the day, which is Mark chapter 6. Here we've followed in the previous passage, Jesus has been over on the Gentile side of the Lake of Galilee, healing famously one of the stories is the Gerasene demoniac. He's now back and back in his home territory, and he's preaching in the synagogue, so he's back amongst his kind of own, if you like, and we enter into this conversation about where he gets this wisdom. So there are themes that trace across, again, our New Testament readings here about where Jesus gets his wisdom. You know, he seems to be limited in the deeds of power he can do in this place. And of course, that famous line about prophets are not without honor except in their hometown, among their own kin, and in their own house. Gary, what do you make of this reading?
Probably not as much as you, Robin, but
I don't know.
But I mean, the kinds of things that stand out to me are indeed the fact that he wasn't able to do as many deeds of power in his hometown as elsewhere. I've had a few hometowns in my life, mm-hmm. and it's amazing how impervious hometowns can be to whatever you happen to be offering. There's something painful about that, obviously. If you feel like you're on a mission from God and your hometown doesn't seem to think that your mission from God is really terribly important, then that can be quite painful. But on the other hand, it can also be an appropriately chastening kind of experience. There's nothing, it's often said, you know, there's no one like your own family to bring you down to earth.
Yes, keep you real.
If you're starting to float above the surface on like a kite on the wind or something, there's nothing like your own family to bring you down to earth. Mm. So there's something appropriately sort of chastening in this, I think, which is worth reflecting on, particularly in the light of, you know, 2 Corinthians and, you know, the story of the passion that happens later on in the gospel where Jesus becomes extremely limited in his power. And there is no, of course, resurrection story in at the end of Mark. So there's that kind of thing. I mean, the other stuff, obviously, about the prophet in the hometown is that... I often say to candidates, actually, I say to candidates, here's a plan, right? You too can be like Jesus. You can grow up in a church. You can train to be a minister. You can get yourself ordained. You can get yourself a parish. And then you can discover that no one's that interested in what you have to share.
Yeah.
Is this the kind of leadership that you want to offer? By the way, it'll probably only be a one-year ministry because, you know, according to Matthew, Mark and Luke, Jesus' ministry lasted for 1 year and it was a spectacular failure as far as I can see. Do you really want to be like Jesus? At that point there's often a bit of silence and but anyway.
Yep. Are you suggesting Jesus is not actually our model for leadership?
No, I don't think Jesus is our model for leadership, not for sustained long-term leadership. Mm.
No,
Robin,
that's right. No.
You know, I think there is something to be said for distinguishing between a pastoral ministry and a prophetic ministry.
Yep.
I think very few of us are called to be prophets and it's pretty short, sharp and brutal. I don't really see Jesus as a sort of paradigm for pastoral ministry, which is sustained and long-term and is going to incrementally change things.
Yeah.
This is not your guy.
Yeah. I mean, and again, that theme here, I mean, I'm fascinated that, you know, Jesus is actually limited. There's something profound and also just I think we can probably all relate to is that Jesus himself, you know, the guy who in the previous chapter was calming the storms and healing the sick is here limited by the sort of belief and expectations of others. That could be actually quite comforting for some of us, but also a reminder of that weakness that, you know, that we experience God's grace and arguably our ministry in those points of weakness.
I'm struck that he was amazed. I don't know. I was struck in these Mark and readings by how they're astounded and he's amazed. And
yeah, there's lots of amazement that goes on.
I'm wondering
it's
whether
because they're mostly men, Fran.
Yeah.
what's bleedingly obvious to women is not bleedingly obvious to men, and so we're constantly amazed, right?
Oh, that's good. That's a good. Yeah,
thank you. See, we can't say that, but you can.
That's good. the next part of the reading where he's going out and teaching, he calls the 12 and he sends them out two by two. I think there's preaching points here or discussion point around mission and evangelism and our often in mainstream Western Christianity, our ambivalence about both of those things and indeed our checkered history in other lands and perhaps our own.
Yep. Well, and again, there's reliance in this model. So there's the same elements of weakness we've articulated in other ways because if you send people out with no bread, no bag, no money in your belts and not a spare tunic, you're actually saying wherever you go, you're going to be reliant on the hospitality of others. And implied in that is, you know, the need to build relationships because you can't – no one's going to look after you if you aren't actually open and vulnerable and building relationships to go stay in their houses or whatever. You know, this works on some ancient understandings of the way hospitality functioned that is a bit different or quite different really to Western culture. But again, I think speaks to something that's deeply relational. This isn't the two by two knocking on your front door and handing you in their suits or their nice clothing and handing you a tract and saying, come to my church up the road. This is about going out with huge vulnerability.
In need.
And building relationship in need, not taking I've got the answer, I've got the Jesus movie to show you, or I've got the food.
I believe the Jesuits training involves an expedition like this. I don't know whether either of you have heard of it, where they have to go out,
Sounds terrifying, quite frankly.
You know, across Australia and with nothing and rely on the hospitality of others. And what that's like? What's that like spiritually? And what's it like?
A lot of the
what are called apostolic orders or the mendicant orders in particular in sort of Western Christianity, this was built into the vows that you weren't allowed to own anything really much of your own. You were dependent upon the hospitality of others, and you know a lot of the people who founded these orders talked a lot about the spirituality of poverty, how you get in touch with the poverty of Christ and Christ's reliance on his Father and those sorts of things by doing this because, you know, the people who offer you hospitality are the face of God. for you.
Yeah.
They provide for you. So a lot of those kinds of orders came out of a fairly literal reading, took these sorts of passages, particularly from Mark, very, very seriously indeed.
There's also an instruction here of what to do if they don't hear you. Just go.
Yes.
Shake the dust.
I mean, but yes. And the ministry, I mean, the other thing is word and deed are joined together here. It's they're preaching, there's testimony, but they're also casting out demons, which is something about addressing evil and injustice in perhaps our language, and they're anointing with oil the sick and healing. I mean, so there is, you know, practical help and healing, not in the patronizing charity model of I bring this to you, but there's practical help and healing accompanying the words that is about engaging whole human beings.
Yeah, and would engage them back into the community in the communal sense. Thank you so much for joining us again, Gary. We've gone a bit over time, but that's all good for everyone.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to Gary's book, Gondwana Theology.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.